This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Seeing a number of different fronts where traditional environmental groups are coming together with non-traditional ones, and we're realizing if we're going to win this campaign, we've got to come together.
Most of the time, when we hear about bureaucratic delays, it's with a sigh and a moan, especially this week when the federal government is almost completely shut down. But when it comes to the Keystone XL pipeline, a bureaucratic delay is a welcome reprieve for the activists and environmental groups fighting the controversial plan to build a pipeline that would transport tar sands crude oil from Canada through the U.S. This week on Sea Change Radio, I speak with Michael Marks, the director of the Sierra Club's Beyond Oil campaign. We discuss the new economics of tar sands oil, the options for the petroleum industry if the Keystone is blocked, and how the fight over the pipeline has helped to energize groups like his. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Michael Marks. He's the director of the Sierra Club's Beyond Oil campaign. Michael, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
When we talk about Beyond Oil, this is a pretty large concept. It can go from clean energy to fighting the Keystone XL pipeline, which I know you've put a lot of energy into. Why don't you first give us the elevator pitch of what the mission is for your organization?
Well, I'd say the elevator pitch is this, that if we're going to move, it's imperative that we move beyond oil. That when you look at the amount of greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuels in the United States, 42% of them come from oil, more than coal, more than natural gas. And if we're going to get up beyond oil, first we've got to keep the dirty oil that's really coming on in the ground, tar sands oil, fracked oil, deep water oil. And then the second half is we really need to accelerate the pace at which we move to clean alternatives like electric vehicles. We get people out of their cars into rapid transit and for that matter, walking and bicycles. So Beyond Oil campaign is really two-sided. One, it's about keeping the oil that's coming online in the ground as much as possible. And two, about really accelerating the pace at which we're shifting to these clean alternatives.
And why don't you give us a kind of a status report on some of the successes of your campaigns up till now and what you're striving to achieve?
Well, let's talk about the supply side. I think that the big success on that side is really tar sands. This is a huge energy project. It's like the third largest proven reserve of oil in the world, 178 billion barrels of oil. Just to give you an idea, I think Saudi Arabia is like 210 billion barrels of oil. And
Are you talking proven reserves?
Proven reserves. And the key to stopping the expansion of the tar sands is really to block the infrastructure so it can't get to market, because it's located way up in northeastern Alberta. And so it has to be shipped by pipeline, ideally, to different coasts, like the west or east coast of Canada, or to the Gulf Coast of the United States, in order to get to the international market. So the Keystone XL is the primary vehicle for getting it to the Gulf Coast of Texas. And it's also the largest proposed pipeline, although they've just proposed another one now that's a little bit larger than that. So one of the things we've been able to do working with Canadian groups is block all the proposed pipelines. So they haven't been able to get the oil to market. And as a result, a lot of the investors and companies that have already, they've got these approved operations that were going to be developed, they're not investing the money because they don't know whether the oil is actually going to be able to get to the international market yet. So I think on the supply side, that's one of the biggest successes.
I was talking to a friend of mine last winter about the Keystone XL pipeline, and he was saying, you know, if we don't build that, China will get it and it'll go out west. But you're talking about some of the alliances you've been able to forge with Canadian activists, environmental groups, and indigenous people who have kept that Western pipeline a distant dream for oil extractors. Is that correct?
Exactly. You know, when we first started this campaign, there was a pipeline called the Northern Gateway Pipeline that was going to go across British Columbia up to a northern port called Kitimat. And we worked with a number of the groups up there. They really took the lead, but among them was Sierra Club British Columbia. But First Nations up there own the territories that that pipeline has to cross. And 100% of them oppose that pipeline. In fact, there's a couple of First Nations who basically said to Enbridge, which is the company that would have built the pipeline, if any of your employees step foot in our territory, we'll arrest them and we'll prosecute them under our law. That's huge. So First Nations blocked that one with the environmental group's help up there. The other one that was proposed was the Trailbreaker Line 9 pipeline that would have gone from Quebec out to Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine. Now, right now, that pipeline exists, but it actually brings oil in from Maine up to Quebec. But what was proposed is that they build a spur line that would go up to Alberta, and they'd reverse the pipeline so that the oil could come down from Alberta to Quebec and out to Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine, and then be exported from there.
Like a St. Lawrence passageway. Mm-hmm.
And that pipeline's also blocked, in not only because of the opposition in the United States from those three states, but also from Quebec, which in Canada is the real ground zero for the opposition party to the Conservatives that are currently in power. You know, the tar sands are really in trouble in a lot of ways.
When you say the tar sands, you mean just the actual, the business behind
the business,
extraction
yes.
of the tar sands.
So this, you know, area the size of Florida is actually what's being projected to be exploited. It's all covered by forests in northeastern Alberta, but at the end, you've got to pretty much clear-cut all of those forests or fragment those forests pretty badly to get the oil out. But one of the problems they're running into is that the best market for their oil has been the United States. We import about two-thirds of the oil that's produced in the tar sands. The problem is that the refineries that really changed over, invested in the cokers necessary to process tar sands oil, pretty much at capacity. And what's happening now is tight oil is coming on so fast from the Bakken area in North Dakota and from the Permian and Eagle Ford plays down in Texas, that the demand for tar sands oil in the United States is virtually nil, at least for more tar sands oil over and above what they've been exporting to us over the last several years. So it's really starting to kill the demand for tar sands, such that companies like Suncor, that were investing in big upgraders, billion-plus-dollar upgraders, so that they could even turn their heavy oil into a little more synthesized, lighter crude so they could then ship it down, they pulled the plug on those operations because they realized there's just no more demand for tar sands oil. That's why the Keystone is so interesting a story, because they originally sold it as it was going to give us energy security from our neighbor to the north. The reality is we don't need any more tar sands oil. It's actually going to be exported. And in fact, where U.S. oil, crude oil cannot be exported from the U.S. without an exemption from the Commerce Department, Canadian crude oil could be exported as crude without an exemption because it originates in a foreign country.
And there haven't been any refineries built in quite some time in the
30
U.S., right?
30-plus years.
30-plus years. And so that's one of the thorns in the side of big oil, is the government won't let us build these things, or is it because it's not financially viable?
It's the latter. In fact, there was a proposed pipeline in Union County, South Dakota, called the Hyperion Refinery. It was the first one proposed in over 30 years. And we fought that refinery along with some other groups. And basically, at the end of the day, we made it difficult. But I think the real reason that it wasn't built is they just couldn't get the investors. It was, for whatever reason, that just wasn't seen as a financially viable operation. And building a refinery is a really expensive proposition. That's the reason why Canada ships all their oil south. They don't want to build any more refineries up there. It's way too expensive. They can't afford it.
But these companies have deep enough pockets to make far-reaching investments in clean energy instead of these contingency plans in case oil goes to $150 or whatever dollars a barrel. And is that one of the goals of your campaign, is to try to have these well-moneyed interests see that the future is not burning fossil fuel?
It really is. But it's an uphill climb when it comes to oil companies. And I'll tell you the reason. Companies like BP, you know, once said BP is going to stand for not British Petroleum anymore, but Beyond Petroleum.
Right. I was like, but you are a petroleum company.
But you are a petroleum company. But at least at one point, you know, their CEO was very visionary in saying this is not the future. And what happened is, as soon as he was gone, came in and just said, we're British Petroleum. We're going to be in the petroleum business. And besides, we can't make anywhere near the kind of profits we can make by going to clean energy as we can make by staying in petroleum. And so now what you have is all these oil companies, in some instances, selling off the research wings that were looking at R&D for alternative and clean energy. And they're just doubling down on petroleum, and they're doubling down on their political contributions to candidates, to public elected officials, just to make sure that they can protect their investments.
So you had mentioned the supply side issues and the barriers that need to be overcome on the supply side. What about the demand side, Michael?
Well, on the demand side, some interesting things are happening. First of all, as a result of the recession, the demand for oil in the U.S. is going down. Secondly, if you look at the average vehicle miles traveled per person, which is one way of measuring the demand for oil, it's actually going down. People are using their cars less. If you look at the sale of electric vehicles, in the last year alone, they doubled in the United States. So we can actually see some pretty positive signs that that if we can project this out a few years, the demand for oil is going to continue to go down in the United States. And that's, by the way, one of the reasons, again, why these tar sands companies, and for that matter, the tight oil companies now operating in the Bakken and Permian and Eagle Ford, are so interested in getting their oil to a coast so they can export it to China or India. So that's our next real challenge, I think, is that we have to really continue to stop tar sands from getting to the coast, particularly the Gulf Coast and the East Coast through Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine. But we also have to now go to work and stop tight oil, the fracked oil, from getting to the coast through rail cars, which is their primary mode of transport, where they're now in Washington State proposing export terminals that would take it off to China.
Follow the shift to sustainability with SeaChange Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio. I'm speaking to Michael Marks. He's the director of the Sierra Club's Beyond Oil campaign. Michael, I want to return to the Keystone XL pipeline and the political machinations behind it later, but why don't you tell us about, from your perspective, how the fight against pipelines such as the Keystone has energized a whole new segment of the environmental movement?
Yeah, I really appreciate that question, because I think people underestimate just how iconic and important the Keystone fight has been. I think some people think, well, it's a misguided target. It's only going to carry 830 barrels of oil a day. But the reality is that this was a target that, first of all, opened up the entire tar sands, a huge amount of the tar sands. So it's strategic. But what happened is a little bit of kind of a case study of the climate movement in a way. Originally, the fight against the Keystone XL was very intellectual. It was a lobbying. It was reports on the environmental impacts along the pipeline, the safety of pipelines. So it was really grounded in, very close to the, you know, the earth in terms of these are the issues we're facing, and it's going to go over the Ogallala Aquifer, and it could possibly break, and so it could possibly threaten that. At one point, when I was in my role as director of the international campaign, Bill McKibben of 350.org came and said, "You know, I think we're going to lose this fight if we don't have civil disobedience." And I was absolutely convinced he was right, and I was having a really difficult time convincing other organizations to come in and engage in civil disobedience. Within several months, 1,253 people were arrested in front of the White House. One of the things I've learned over the last 25 years of being in this movement is that people outside the environmental movement really ask the question, are you willing to put your body, are these groups willing to put their body on the line? When they would see Greenpeace hanging off buildings or oil derricks, et cetera, they may have disagreed, but they looked at it and said, wow, that must be a pretty serious issue. And I think a lot of people were looking at climate change and they were saying, cap and trade, I don't understand it. What's that about? It's confusing to me. It seems to me that nobody in the environmental movements are really putting their bodies on the line. And I think that they really didn't. They didn't think that this was a really emotional fight until those people got arrested. When they got arrested, that sent a signal to the entire environmental movement that this issue was kind of moving to the top of the chain in terms of its emotional priority. And also what happened is when Bill McKibben and then James Hansen, the head of the Goddard Space Center at the time, came in and said, if the tar sands are developed, it's game over for climate change. I think that suddenly reframed the whole issue out of safety and energy security and into climate. And suddenly, groups like Sierra Club and 350.org were able to do a rally in the middle of winter last year when we thought that we were on the verge of a decision by the president that brought 50,000 people to Washington, D.C., the biggest climate rally in history in the United States. So it's civil disobedience. It's the fact that the president has the power to make the decision. It doesn't have to go through Congress. I think it's the fact that we reframed it in terms of climate there, and that people were really frustrated about the fact that cap and trade, which was in many ways something foundations invested hundreds of millions of dollars to try and get passed, had failed. And I think this became like our moment to kind of show our frustration and to really kind of energize the movement. And it's actually been quite successful.
Sticking with the idea of the framing, the message framing, I've spoken to George Lakoff for this show before, and one of his mantras is that liberals don't go on offense with their messaging as much. Democrats play defense. Republicans are saying drill, baby, drill, or whatever it is. They're attacking Obama or Obamacare. They're playing into fear. And environmental groups such as Greenpeace and Sierra Club and NRDC throughout the years have been considered to be closely aligned with save the whales, save the forest, save this. But now it seems like with the new messaging behind the Beyond Oil campaign in that Sierra Club, the Beyond Coal, Beyond Natural Gas, it sounds like you're going on offense in some
mm-hmm.
ways.
I think we are.
Is that an intentional messaging strategy?
I think it is. I think the movement's realizing that there's two sides to the framing coin. One side is the negative, and that is some variation of oil is killing us. It's killing us in terms of our international security, killing us in terms of our children and health. Thousands of kids and adults actually die prematurely every year due to emissions from oil. It's killing us in terms of the environment and oil spills. It's killing us economically. Every time we have an oil shock, we have a recession shortly thereafter. So there's the negative frame. And with the Keystone, we had a negative frame. It is the fused. It is game over for climate if Keystone is built. James Hansen gave us the frame, and it worked fabulously. so far. But the, and then there's the positive side. And the positive side is beyond oil. It is a union concerned scientist, in fact, just did some interesting research. And the frame that came out was we can reduce our dependence on oil 50% by 2030. In 20 years, we could have 50 consume 50% less oil. And their research and their interviews, and when they started kind of going out and testing that with people and showing people that it was possible, it really ignited a lot of optimism from people. So I think you have to combine both the negative and to stigmatize the industry, the status quo, with the hopeful, the optimistic, the exciting, which tells you there's a better life beyond the status quo.
Establishing the reality, but also instilling a vision for people.
I think as a movement, we've done a pretty terrible job of selling our vision of what a future is like that's beyond fossil fuels. And I think we're now reaching a tipping point where, in fact, the price on electric cars is coming down. Batteries are dropping in price every year.
Red states like Arizona and Texas are embracing solar energy in record numbers.
You've got Republican, you got a Republican mayor in Indianapolis, who's one of the most progressive in terms of, you know, really changing over their whole transportation system to a green transportation system. So I think ultimately that this is an issue, if you're not in the pocket of oil, if they're not, you know, putting a huge amount of money into your campaign coffers, it doesn't take long to realize the economic benefits of going green.
And then from a financial standpoint, you're still, when I say you, I mean the environmental movement, is still up against some very deep pockets filling the coffers for decision makers on every level of our government and in boardrooms as well. One of the things that Lakoff had mentioned that discussion as well is that there's such fragmentation in the environmental movement. All these organizations with very good ideas and trying to move in the same basic direction, but fighting over those same dollars. Do you see there being some solutions to that seemingly intractable problem? How do we get critical mass within the environmental movement to compete with big oil?
Well, there's definitely that case, and it is a problem. I think it's a problem in a couple of ways. One is that I think foundations felt burned after they invested hundreds of millions of dollars into the cap and trade fight, and then the political landscape shifted from under them, and we lost that fight. And I think they stepped back and went, now what do we do? And they decided to invest their money in coal. Oil seemed a lot more complex, and I don't think they saw a real path forward. Now what I think is happening is foundations are coming together, so that helps. And they're kind of looking for strategies that really can help them unite and focus their funding. So now NGOs are coming on, and by NGOs I mean non-government organizations, advocacy groups like the Sierra Club and Greenpeace and Rainforest Action Network, but as well as the NAACP, the National Council of La Raza, the Truman Security Group. So groups that are traditional enviros have come together in a coalition called the Moving Beyond Oil Coalition with groups that are not traditionally environmental groups. And we're actually seeing a number of different fronts where traditional environmental groups are coming together with non-traditional ones, and we're realizing if we're going to win this campaign, we've got to come together. And we've got to bring the perspectives of different constituencies into a movement, which is what makes a movement successful.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with the director of the Sierra Club's Beyond Oil campaign, Michael Marks. Michael, why don't we return back to the Keystone XL for a second? We've been covering this on Sea Change Radio for over a year now, and it's gone from... It's been quite a roller coaster from understanding the politics behind it, and whether it's EPA is going to be making the final determination for the White House's decision, or if it's going to be the State Department. Where are we now? And with blinders off, how realistic is it that your efforts are going to succeed and you're going to stop this Keystone XL pipeline from being
built? Well, when we started out, we set out objectives of all the different tar sands infrastructure around North America. And on the Keystone, and we had to put a probability of success. And on the Keystone, we put 10% probability of success. So we thought, all right, there's ancillary benefits to fighting this.
Which we just discussed.
Now, where we're at is that, amazingly, President Obama, in his climate speech at Georgetown, the morning of, wrote in two paragraphs addressing the Keystone XL pipeline and saying that if it significantly contributed to climate change, it would not be approved. That was huge. We've been fighting this pipeline for over 4 years at that point, and no one had ever in the administration ever talked in terms of climate. We were the only ones that talked in terms of climate. And this was, by the way, post-rally in D.C. So when Obama said that, he really kind of handed the hot potato over to John Kerry, who is the head of the Department of State and who has the authority to really now kind of provide the recommendation to the White House on this, the final recommendation. Kerry has a very strong record on climate. And we personally think that Obama has really given him a green light to kill this pipeline. So what also happened is Kerry, the Department of State, received feedback on its supplemental environmental impact statement from the EPA that basically said they did a terrible job and that they ignored a lot of the economics that we've just talked about, rail cars, the fact that these pipelines are blocked, this oil's not going to get to market.
The refinery issues.
The EPA criticized the supplemental environmental impact statement on a number of different grounds and said, you need to go back and start over. And then Sierra Club challenged the fact that it was done by a biased entity that is a card-carrying member of the American Petroleum Institute. And the inspector general of the Department of State agreed and is now conducting an investigation and says, we probably won't be done with our investigation until somewhere in the first quarter of 2014, which basically could conclude that indeed it was a biased process. The whole supplemental environmental impact statement is invalid because of that.
So delaying this is in the best interest of people who don't want to see this pipeline built, to see delays in the decision-making.
The longer
process.
It's delayed, the more the costs go up, the more the competitors kind of outrace them.
And more alternatives big oil's going to have to look for.
More time we have for breakthroughs in batteries, you know, electric batteries.
Or from their perspective, other countries to go extract oil from.
Other countries to supply oil, you're right, and beat them out. And I'll just add one last note, and that was the Interior Department. To our surprise, even though we were lobbying, the Interior Department came through and said that when they looked at the supplemental environmental impact statement, it ignored a lot of the obvious environmental impacts, and they had to go back and they needed to revisit those too. It was a threat to a number of endangered species and to their habitat. So right now, I'd give us about a 66% chance of winning this.
He's the director of the Sierra Club's Beyond Oil campaign, Michael Marks. Michael, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Jimi Hendrix, Eric Clapton, and The Jam.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. and tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.